Guardian Unlimited.
Well, here we are this morning with Feist. Very nice to meet you.
Hello. Good morning.
Now, we've caught you in the middle of a jaunt across the UK. So you've also spent several years working in Paris, and you also worked in Berlin too. Where do you call home nowadays?
The DNA is still Canadian. Yeah, I mean, the more time I spent away from Canada, the more I felt Canada being, you know, really the identity that I could relate to the most easily, you know. Which isn't to say that being in that bubble of anonymity, not knowing the language, and that kind of writing your own movie in your head as you walk around a place you don't know anything about, that's still, you know, becomes a huge part the more time you spend away of the way you start to relate to things. But I guess at the end of the day, it's the Lego pieces are all Canadian.
Let's talk a little bit then about those kind of the building of the jigsaw and your kind of formative years as a musician. We hear a lot about the broken social scene and all that kind of stuff that's going on in Toronto, but how did you get involved in making music?
Well, I guess the real genesis was when I was about 15. I was singing in a lot of choirs from the time I was a really little kid. And when I was about 15, these girls came up to me in the hall at school and they said, "You're in the choir?" And I said, "Yeah." And they said, "But we see you at all the gigs every weekend and you have a mohawk and you're wearing your Doc Martens or whatever with the uniform of in Calgary terms." I mean, it's so funny being in Britain talking about it because it was the early 90s in Canada. And it was, you know,
83 in London. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's how long it took to get there. But still, the hardcore scene was going on. But I had never really found a way in except as an audience member. And these girls said, "Let's start a band." So one of their dads had been in a cover band all through the 80s and had a huge PA system because in those days you'd bring everything. You'd bring your sound, your lights. You'd set up in some bar in some mountain town in the middle of nowhere and play, you know, Fleetwood Mac covers or whatever. So yeah, she had a crazy drum kit that my uncle is also a collector, a gear collector. So at one point he dropped by and was just aghast at this amazing gear. We were, you know, we were 15, 16-year-olds. He's like, "This is a collector's," you know. But it was just crazy. If I look back, I think. And then when I was about 17, I bought her dad's van off of him. So we started to tour in the van that he had toured in.
With the proceeds that you'd made from all the gigs you'd been doing previous?
No, from being a dishwasher.
Hard working.
But yeah, we started to jam and really just instantly put ourselves in that scene. And really it was, I mean, that was half a lifetime ago. I'm 30 now and that was when I was 15. So I kind of blow my own mind when I think of that.
A third album, an artist's third album, it can be a real make or break album for them. Did you feel a lot of pressure for this to be a commercially successful album compared to the first two?
Well, I guess if third is the make or break, then it's the next, you know, as far as anyone's concerned, this is really my second record because the first one, about 8 people heard it. So I love that you know that there even was one before, but it was really more training wheels for me. You know, it was, nobody really heard it. And that in a way set the tone for the way I was going to approach the later ones. It was, I mean, the first one was the first 10 songs I'd ever written. And then the second one was really like a sabbatical from all of the collaborations I had been doing kind of in between the end of Monarch, when I was done, you know, just driving all over North America in a rented minivan, playing in front of 18 people and feeling that success every single time I sold one CD out of my own hand into someone else's. I think I sold about 2,500 of them or something. It was, and that felt like, yeah, I did it, you know? But then I was so tired and there were all these way more fun things going on. Like Broken Social Scene was just a little embryo at that time, just beginning. And Peaches was my roommate and I started to back her up at her live shows. My buddies Gonzalez and Maki moved to Europe, but we did some recording with them. I was in another band called Royal City that was not country, but a little bit just super simple and perfect harmonies and very quiet. And so I was doing all these different projects and each one felt like my own. If I was being involved, if I was spending that much time doing that, it was usually because it was absorbed into me into some deeper way than just being a sideman. Although I did love being a sideman. I really loved supporting someone else's vision and you see exactly what's going to help it, right? You know, as opposed to being at the center of the the eye of the storm. There's something about being just off to the side and you can see the storm and then you can help the storm, you know. I was wanting
to ask you about those collaborations, because I mean, yeah. I suppose we always hear about the kind of the egotistical rock and roll star, and but there just seems to have been this kind of a real ability for people to support each other and work together and, as you say, improve each other's work. Is that something that came naturally, or was there a lot of competition when these things were going on?
It's funny because all of the expat Canadian crew that all ended up in Europe, we talk about it sometimes, you know, what, it's so weird. We all, you know, when Peaches was just making her last record, she knew, oh, I need Gonzalez to play drums on that one song. And when Maki's making his record, he says, I really need Feist to come sing on those two songs. And for me, it's, I'm making my record. It's like, oh, I need Maki to do, you know what I mean? It's kind of like each of us are. And then, of course, you can expand that to include all those other bands I just mentioned, mm-hmm. you know. We always say it's like each of us is a movie director and we're all making our own movies. But we all also have at times been PAs and done lights and, you know, been in the editing room or whatever, you know. And it's just when the person... So we all have that directorial, you know, clarity about our own project, but we ended up being a director by doing other jobs or something, you know. So basically each one of us knows what to be pulling from the others. And I mean, then we've talked about, well, we should do a Canadian crew album, all of us, sort of reunion 7 years after we first started coming across the sea, you know.
Yeah.
And then we think, well, what would that be? Because then everybody would be the director again. And usually it works when we kind of pass the conch around.
The songs and the reminder, am I right in thinking they've been around for quite a long time, quite a few years?
Some of them,
songs that made it onto the album. It's not always that usual that an artist will play those songs before they've been heard on an album. Is it important to you to get to premiere those songs to people live and to get feedback? And do they affect how that song sounds when it makes it onto the album?
Yeah, I remember when Mushaboom was first kind of a single in France, and I played in France, and I think I had it fourth in the set list or something, because as far as I was concerned, that was where it worked best. And as far as how it pieced in with all the rest of the songs. And I remember someone from the label or something was just scratching his head and looking at me and going, well, you really don't make it easy on yourself. And I thought, what was I supposed to do? Oh, that's so Metallica, you play the, or that's so The Police or Pink Floyd, you play the hit at the end. I mean, that's, I remember.
Would you do that now?
Well, now I guess I get it. You know, I guess it's sort of, you know, you don't blow off the fireworks. You know, usually when you're a little kid, you're watching it, the fireworks, it's usually bang, pop, bang. And then, you know, 10 minutes after you're, ooh, then they give you the real, goes crazy, you know. But anyway, yeah, as far as the way things are supposed to be done, I always kind of forget. And I'm just doing them the way that in that moment I need to or something. But yeah, the live shows somehow have always felt a little bit like they happen in the moment and then they're over, you know. And in that time, you really can use them for anything you want. And you can fill the space and fill that time. And it's this kind of mercurial quality to all these individuals coming into a room and creating a group. And they don't know each other, but here we are. And now we're all going to define this space and time together. And I'm part of the equation. We're all part of the equation. And in that space and time, I usually would just feel a kind of safety of like anything goes, anything can happen, and it's all safe and it's all allowed, it's all fine. And I mean, and then everyone dissipates and they all take a little piece and it's over. You know, of course, that's not really the case anymore because everyone's cell phone is like they can make feature length Hollywood films. but at the same time, yeah, playing the songs before they made it to the record for me was, I mean, I kind of learned immediately which songs I were going to fight for their right to be on the record. I mean, 1, 2, 3, 4, from the first time I ever played it live, its embryo, early stages version, it was clear that, I mean, people immediately could sing along, and it was something that was pumping the fists in the air. And I thought, oh, well, there's a visual truth that I can't deny that is maybe a good indication of what might happen if this song makes it onto a record. So it's a little laboratory, you know, for what to do later.
Do you ever find, in terms of responses from the press, do you find a certain reluctancy on behalf of the indie set to accept that they actually really like your music for example, there's a quote from Stylist magazine that says a song from your second album sounds the way spring weather feels, an ideal complement to a light lunch of, say, broccoli linguine, which is sort
linguine's a light lunch. They don't know what they're talking about.
But that's sort of the sense that they are trying very hard to define something that is actually quite difficult for them to say that they like a music that maybe appeals to lots of different kinds of people. Or,
well, I think Let It Die, having a few years from it, distance from it now, and I mean, in one sense, I knew exactly what we were doing. In another, it was a total stepping into the minefield of not knowing what. Because, like I said, it was a sabbatical from everything I had been doing. And what I'd been doing is supporting other people's things and mostly playing guitar and touring. And none of it was really about my own songwriting. So when Gonzalez and I went in to make that record, it was the whole point was to do things that neither of us had really done, which was, in his case, beat making and singing and producing his own music, and his own kind of identity was the, you know, the center point of, it was one of the helixes in the double helix, you know. But in this case, for him, it was to take out his voice and take out his own songwriting and see what it was to produce something outside of himself. And for me, it was to put down the guitar and the crackly four track and the lo-fi guided by voices sort of hiss on the, which I love, and which all the recordings I'd made my whole life have been like that. And that's where I come from, you know. That's what really, when I listen to records, that's what I appreciate in them. Although now I've started to figure out, you know, Stardust is a pretty great too, you know. But yeah, so we were just doing something totally unfamiliar. The whole point was to try something that neither of us would know where we were going next. Every moment was a pivot and could end up anywhere. And it was one song at a time, and I didn't know we were making a record, and it was really just two friends. We'd been on tour for 9 months. It was, well, hey, you've got all those songs, why don't we try to put them in the piano context? And for me, it was just, it made them all feel timeless, like you could hear any singer singing them, which was so new to me and new to my ears. And here we were in Europe, what difference is it going to make? No one's ever going to hear it, kind of thing, you know. So it's not that I disagree that it complements a light lunch or something, because it was really, I mean, like I said, I'm a guitar player. I'd played in rock bands my whole life. Making a record like Let It Die was, for me, absolutely about doing something different. It wasn't about defining something that I understood what sense it was going to make to people. First of all, no one had ever heard anything I'd done except the rock bands, and it had always been kind of cult following. I mean, people hearing what I do or did was never part of the equation. I was always under the radar, and it was my home, you know. I was comfortable there. I never assumed anything other than that was going to happen. I guess the reminder for me was a way to start to comprehend that, okay, there might be people listening now, the safety, the kind of benevolence of people's reaction to Let It Die, that being something that I found I couldn't stand next to about half of the record after a couple years of touring. The covers just slowly got guillotined off the set list, and I wasn't interested in playing them anymore. And I thought, well, I've never sung a cover before, recording an album of half covers, and I'm a guitar player, and I had to take this record that had no guitar on the road and find a way to interpret it so it made sense. And then, you know, in that 3 years of touring, about halfway through, I realized I wasn't even trying to interpret Let It Die anymore. I was just working on something, you know, that basically ended up becoming the reminder. And it was more about the amalgam of all the things I'd done over the years, mixed with that awareness that I guess people were listening for the first time. It's all still a new experience.
I mean, what you've been telling us is kind of, you know, a really interesting story of kind of you being able to do things at particular times that kind of suited your frame of mind and also suited your circumstances. Do you think you'll be able to have that fluidity, your ability to kind of adapt and try what you want to do in future? Or do you think you'll be more expected to tour, produce albums, and get on the cycle?
Yeah, the cycle, the hamster wheel.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's not that I have to tour and make records, but I do love it. And it's what I mean, I've just found the frame to put everything inside of. You know, touring is something that, you know, it reinvents itself every night. It kind of sheds its own skin. It disappears and then reappears every day. And it's almost like a moving art installation. I mean, your life becomes this repetition with differences. You know, it's a very interesting, bizarre way to live. And then making records is this sort of this immortality thing. It's like chipping away at the stone to make the statue that's going to stand there long after you're gone thing. You know, it's
really,
well, it's not like someone listens to the record once and then it bursts into flames and they never get to hear it again.
Sure,
I mean, the
sure.
whole point is that it's, you know, it's going to be there. It's the versions you're making are the defining versions. And then the show is, in a way, for me, that defines more for me. I mean, the ever molting versions for me are more what if I close my eyes, I identify the songs as that more than, I mean, the way the song went last night and that it reared its head on me and said, no, I don't want to be sung, or it was good. You know, that stuff is what, for me, is the more defining versions of the songs. But I know that the records for the rest of the world are what it is. So
do you hope to be remembered when you're gone?
No, I mean, that's never been part of the equation. But I just mean, even within my lifetime, you know, I have to stand next to those versions. And I mean, I love Let It Die, don't get me wrong. It's not like those covers on the record version are something I'm ashamed of. It's just that live, they didn't really survive well. They weren't roadworthy or something, you know?
And going back to the reminder, there's a cover of Sea Lion Woman, which was made famous by Nina Simone. Mm. Is that a reference point that you want people to be thinking of when they're listening to the album? Is that something that you're trying to convey, or is it simply about
Nina, you mean?
Yeah.
Nina Simone? No, I mean, I would really be cursing myself if I tried to put myself next to her. I mean, but no, so when I ended up making an arrangement of that, it was partially because I was touring for about a year and a half solo, and I was really like sleeping myself out. Like, I was just, you know, playing solo, there's this kind of, I mean, there's only so much you can do, but I mean, that I found at that point that I could do. I was playing all the versions, just became chilled out versions, you know, and so I started to master the loop station, which is kind of, you can play along with yourself. I was creating little choirs of girls singing with me, you know, live looping and sampling, and Sea Lion Woman was, for me, I thought, oh great, I can do that. I can easily make the beat, make the bass, you know, I can do that live by myself. So in a way, I was glad to kind of melt together the Ship Sisters and Nina Simone and make a version that, I think, of course, people know Nina's version better, and of course, because not many people listen to these archival recordings, but they maybe should. They're amazing. They're amazing.
So I think we're quickly running out of time, but you know, one final question I suppose might be to look forward and say, you know, what's next? What's next in the short term, and what do you plan to do? Are you going to be taking a break? Are you going to be popping up in some obscure European city working on collaborations with ethnic accordion players?
Actually, that's so funny you should say, because in Paris, the subway musicians were blowing my mind for about 3 years. They're all unbelievable. And I thought, what a project that would be to get together all these amazing musicians who obviously have played for decades, and then this is their gig every day, you know? I always felt like such a, like, how did I fake my way into this, that, you know, I can't move my fingers that quickly, but I get to play proper gigs, and these guys, well, but no, sorry, I'm off to a different topic here, but
I need to stick one all the same.
But no, I mean, it's kind of just begun as far as the reminder goes. It's only been out for a couple months, so the touring, really, if I look at a map of the world, there's a lot of cities I went to on Let It Die, that's going to take me a while to get back to them all again, and then add new places, you know? So pretty much, if I was to, I try not to think about it, but all the way until like next fall, like not yeah. this fall, but the one after, it's pretty much all mapped out for, with all those obscure cities listed.
So you'll have enough different versions of your songs to be going on by then, I
suppose. Yeah, who knows what it'll sound like by then.
Guardian Unlimited.